Fighting well is the pursuit of a lifetime. You may be at mile marker one of this wonderful life journey and thinking for the first time about embracing the life of a writer. Or maybe you're further along and ready to publish some of your ideas. I'm Melissa Parks with Dade Getz, and we are fellow travelers on this extended road trip to improve our writing and publish our ideas. We hope this podcast helps you make progress on your writing journey. Now, let's buckle up and write. If you're thinking of writing a memoir, you'll need to prepare yourself for the deep and often painful dig into some difficult memories. Cheryl Lanz, author of soon-to-be-released The Best I Can, knows the struggle. It took her nearly two decades to write her memoir because the memories were so painful. In her memoir, Cheryl candidly shares her journey of dealing with her husband's mental illness and all the cascading, often scary things that happened as a result. In today's interview, Cheryl offers advice to aspiring memoirists, specifically about how to be honest about people without villainizing them, how to think through structuring your memoir to engage your reader from the get-go, and advice for persevering in the writing process. Welcome, Cheryl, to our podcast. We are so excited to have a conversation with you today about your memoir and memoir writing experience.
Well, thank you for having me.
So your memoir, The Best I Can Do, is releasing this May, which is really exciting. Can you tell us what inspired you to write your story and also what it's about? Can you give us an overview of it?
So what inspired me to write my story is I wanted people to hear another side of mental illness. The media tends to portray mental illness as people who are violent and people who are on drugs. And the same stereotype follows along with homelessness. But the reality is most people who are mentally ill and or homeless are not in that situation. There can be a variety of reasons that this situation happened to them. And it can happen to all cultures and all walks of life. When this happened with my husband and I, we were a middle-class married couple. We had a perfect marriage. We had no idea that this would happen to my husband. And so I just want people to know that there are other elements to the story and that mental illness affects people in different ways and people get to homelessness in different ways as well.
So can you tell us just the general overview of the storyline? You mentioned what it's about, but can you just give us what you cover in this story of yours specifically, where you start and where you kind of end up?
The Best I Can Do, that's the name of the book. It covers a 20-year period in our lives. It starts at the point where my husband started experiencing subtle symptoms of mental illness, which for him, it was extreme paranoia, and that just kept getting worse and worse, and how it manifested over time, and what happened as a result from he became more distrustful and in everybody, including me, which was very, very heartbreaking for me, as you can imagine. It explores what caused our homelessness, what caused our lives to fall apart. And it, of course, with a memoir, it's from my perspective, obviously. So it's also focusing on my route to surviving this and also recovering, because I had a lot of emotional issues I was dealing with while we were going through this.
How many years separate you from the memories that you're covering in your memoir? So your beginning and your final kind of scene that you share in your memoir, how far into the future are you now? Like, how long did it take you to get to a point where you felt like you could begin writing about these things?
The book ends in 2016. I started writing the book in 2006, and that was at the point where I was almost completely recovered from the financial strain and the other emotional aspects of the situation. But then in the book, there's more that happens after that because of the Great Recession and some other things in the family.
So you are writing as you are going through part of the story that you were experiencing, mm-hmm. is what it sounds like. And you've been on this journey of writing it now for about 18 years. Is that right? You started in 2006. It's taken almost two decades to write this book, which is, I think, really encouraging for people who are in this moment working on a book and have been working on a book for a long time and realizing, you know, it takes persistence. And I would imagine some of the challenge was that a lot of what you were writing about was really painful. So how did you go about dealing with those painful memories and writing about them? And what was your greatest hurdle in tackling those issues?
The reason it took me almost two decades to write this book is because I procrastinated a lot. And the reason I procrastinated a lot was exactly what you said. The memories were painful. When you're writing a memoir, you're having to relive all these experiences again. And a lot of the experiences I went through were bizarre. It was even hard for me to believe I was going through them, but they were happening. And going back to those and then writing about them, it was tough at first. I would write a little bit and then stop because I would hit a point where it was just emotionally too hard to write. And I would keep doing this back and forth, back and forth. And so from 2006 until about 2020 or late 2019, early 2020, I had drafted only six chapters. And the book now has 39 chapters plus the front matter and the appendix. And so it was tough. And there was something I started really picking up when COVID hit. There was something about COVID that just something started nagging at me. It's like, okay, I got to get this book written. Mental illness is a big issue. It's growing. It was growing because of COVID. And I think it's going to keep being a big issue. And so I decided it's time to start doing this. And I still struggled. So finally, I had been following a developmental editor for a long time. I don't remember how I found out about her, but I subscribed to her newsletter years ago. And during COVID, she opened up her services. So this person that I hired, her name is Laura Munson. She used to only work with people who had attended her writing retreats. And so during COVID, she opened up her services to people who had not been at her retreats yet. And so I hired her to help me sort out, you know, writing the book, figuring out what I needed to include in the book, because I was also struggling with that. And having her as someone I could account to, because we were setting up deadlines, you know, I got to create so much by a certain date. That really made a difference. In addition to that, I have a business coach. I started working with her in, it was like 2017, 2018. And that was to help grow my business. My main niche is technical writing, and I'm a full-time freelance technical writer. And so I talked to her about my book one day when we had a session, and she said, well, I can be an accountability partner. So I'm going to give you assignments. And then every month when we meet, I have to give her a report. So having her and my developmental editor pushing me, it forced me to get work done, and it made a difference.
So you mentioned you had six stories and you expanded it to 39, which is a significant increase. And I would imagine your work with the developmental editor had to do a lot with how are you going to organize these chapters and what comes first, what comes next, what comes last. So can you describe to us your approach to thinking about structuring your memoir and what you maybe thought it was going to be and what it ended up being?
when I started working on this book, I thought that I needed to start from the beginning of my relationship with my husband and then go to the end. And it was starting to bog down very, very quickly. And I think aside from reliving the painful memories, I was also struggling because the book seemed to be going nowhere. And so when I started meeting with Laura, the first thing she had me do was create a list of scenes that were important to the book. And so I had to sort through all my experiences and just write them down. And then we went through and reviewed that list. And with Laura's guidance, I was able to pick out the most important scenes that would make the story go forward and have a flow and tell the story more effectively. And it turned out from that's where I landed on the 20-year period. I started from our 5th wedding anniversary, which is where the symptoms were just kind of starting. And I didn't really know what they were. It was just kind of puzzling behavior, but then it would go away for a while and come back weeks, months later until things became full blown. And then it propelled us into the homelessness and the other struggles that we went through.
So how many scenes did you have when you winnowed them down to, I don't know what you would call them, maybe your tentpole scenes or your major scenes? How many were there? Were there 5? Were there 10? And how did that help you move the storyline along?
When I started with the list, I think I had about 5 pages, single-spaced, of scenes, just a list. I think we whittled it down to about maybe 15. But then as I was writing the book, some of the other not major scenes, you know, the less priority scenes wove themselves in just naturally. But those 10 to 15 scenes helped create the foundation of the book.
What was the first thing that the editor did for you, developmental editor, that really jumped you? Was it this very thing, which is, okay, let's go back to listing all your major and minor scenes? Or what was it that, what was the kind of the single thing she did early on that really jump-started that next final phase of your book writing process?
The scene list was the first thing and the major assignment that she gave me to sort out what I needed to include in the book. Because when I contacted her, I was all over the place. I just didn't know how to tackle this project. It was very overwhelming. And so creating that scene list helped me focus on what I needed to focus on and helped me dig deeper into what I needed to communicate.
So how did you go from those multiple pages of scenes down to about 10 to 15 scenes? What was your criteria for winnowing it down to those major scenes that were going to hold your story together?
The way that we did it was, what are the most important scenes that would get the story to flow and to keep the reader interested in the story from beginning to end? So that was our criteria.
And as you think of that criteria, what did you decide would hold the interest of the reader? What were, when you were looking at a story, you're like, yeah, that will capture the attention of the reader. What was the essence of the story that would capture the reader's imagination and keep them moving forward?
The way that we looked at it was, some of the most painful scenes would be the ones that would capture their attention. The way that my editor explained it was that we want to capture the reader's interest, but we also want them to feel what I was going through as an author and root for me as the story goes along.
What you just said I thought was really interesting, is that you wanted to make them root for you. How did you do that? And did you have to be careful that you were not too negative, too sunshiny?
And also not make yourself too heroic at the
same time. Exactly. Yeah, it's a tough balance. I didn't mention I also have a journalism background. I have a journalism degree. I tried to rely on some of that training, trying to step back and be more objective and think about the facts. So, but at the same time, when you're writing a memoir, you can't just spit out the facts. You have to weave in the emotional part. And so it was a tough balance of getting those two together to where the reader would look at it and say, okay, this person is a likable person. She's doing the best that she can to get through the situation. She really loves her husband, although her husband is throwing all these weird behaviors at her, and she's trying to figure out why this is happening, what's going on, how to get through this. And so from that perspective, it was making myself likable so that the readers would be willing to root for me as the experience unfolds.
What I hear you saying is you wrote yourself as a complex character, much like a good fiction writer writes their characters as complex. Like, it was a messy struggle that you were engaged with, and you probably didn't do it perfectly, engage it perfectly, but you hoped for the best for your husband. You were looking for opportunities to change things. So I love that you saw yourself and wrote yourself as a complex character. I think that that's so hard for people to do.
And another thing I started doing, which I had not really intended, was I added another character. I started on this little side theme about trusting your intuition, because there was a lot of that going on during this whole experience. My gut would tell me one thing, and if I didn't listen, sometimes I got in a lot of trouble. So I created a character for this, for the intuition. I called her the wise inner voice, and her name is Charlotte. And I came up with the name because Charlotte's Web is one of my favorite stories. And that name just seemed appropriate for a wise inner voice. And so there are some places in the book where there are little snippets where Charlotte's telling me, you know, you need to do this, or you need to think about this. There are also some other parts in the book where we have a conversation, and sometimes we're kind of arguing with each other. I thought that once I started doing that, and then my editor started looking at it, she goes, this is a great part to add in the book, because one of the things that especially women have a good talent with is they're trusting their intuition. But again, even as women, we ignore things, and then that's where we trip up. And so it was good to examine that throughout the story.
So could you tell us, there's the nadir, the lowest point of where you and your husband were at the low point, but there's also your low point. Are those two the same? And what was your low point, and how did you weave that in? Where did that appear actually in the memoir?
The lowest point was there was a point where my husband and I, our lives took different directions. And that was a low point. But I think my lowest point in the book, which comes later, it's a little past halfway in the book, is where I knew I was going to have to move into my car, because I could not afford the rent. I had to literally make a choice between a place to live and moving into my car. And I had two cats. I'm a big cat fanatic, which I had to give up the cats. And so I took them to their vet, and just asked him if he knew of anyone who would be able to take care of an elderly diabetic cat and this other cat who pretty much loved everybody except little kids. And I think the hardest thing I had to do during this story was part with those cats. Eventually, though, I'm able to get them back. There are some very generous people in the world, and this was one of those situations where I was blessed with reuniting with them.
What I love about that story is it's a pretty simple story, but it really reveals the struggle. I mean, it's such a simple story that I can identify with as a cat lover myself, right? That idea of like, wow, like this thing that I take for granted and brings me so much comfort, and you worry about these cats, like what's going to happen to them? And suddenly I can see that it's such a simple story and yet so profound, and something that the readers can identify with, you know, replace it with the dog if you're not a cat lover.
How did you balance, as you're writing this book and the scenes that you talk about, let's say, let's even talk about those 10 to 15 tentpole or kind of core major movement, major scenes, let's call those. How do you, as you're writing that, create tension? And how did you relieve tension and keep people reading? Did you make them laugh? Was it Charlotte, one of those techniques you added in there to help with that?
There's some comical moments between Charlotte and me, especially when we're arguing about something. Other things, I'm a big nature lover, and my husband was too before he got sick. And so there are a lot of scenes in the book where I'm either talking about something the cats did, like early on, there's a scene, my husband is at work. He was a sales rep for a major food company. And I'm working at home that day. And so one of the cats jumps up on my computer and he's trying to sit on the keyboard. And I know he's going to mess up my writing. And so I had to do something. So one of his favorite games was chasing paper wads and bringing them back to me. So I have a scene in there where we're in the living room. I'm throwing the paper wad. He's coming back. Some other things, there's a chapter farther along in the book where my husband's symptoms are getting worse. And at that point, we moved around a lot. And at this point, we were actually living in two places. He was in New York City studying at NYU, and I was in Massachusetts working full time. And so he was visiting me in Massachusetts when he'd take breaks and visit me. And at this apartment complex where I lived, I found a swan's nest on the creek, and it was just a few steps from my apartment. And so they laid eggs and they hatched a couple of babies, cygnets. And so when my husband visited, he discovered the nest. I didn't tell him about it. I wanted him to find it. And so he did. And so for about 3 months, he spent more time visiting me because he was excited about the swans and he wanted to see what would happen to them. And so at that point, his symptoms subsided. And it was like our romance was rekindling again as these swans were growing up and the parents were teaching them all the things they needed to do to survive in the wild.
That's a really winsome story. And I was going to ask, how does this tie to mental illness? But I see that that's part of the journey, is you have these moments where it becomes very dark, but then there's some lightness interspersed throughout when there's relief, where there's maybe a glimmer of hope that things are going to be different and change. So I love that example of how you relieved some of the tension and offered glimpses of hope throughout the story. That's a wonderful example. How did you use flashbacks in your memoir? So you had these major scenes, and then would you find yourself flashing back to the past to give people context? And how did you think of flashbacks?
I didn't use a lot of flashbacks, and I did try to weave them in as effectively as I could when I did. So this is where a point in the book where it was a one of the darkest times in my life. It was the night before I decided that I had to leave my husband. And it was a very scary experience about what happened. So I don't want to give it away, that part, but I do flash back to my teenage years when I'm going through the decision process on what do I need to do. And what that was all about, during the last 3 years of my teenage years, my mother remarried and the husband was very abusive physically and mentally. And so I was thinking about that while I was deciding, is it time to leave? Do I need to walk out right now?
That's a great example of how to use a flashback effectively, because it informs the way that you're responding today or what you're struggling with today. So that's a great example of a flashback. We find that so many writers struggle with flashbacks. So thanks for sharing that example. Regarding your husband, you were touching some really sensitive topics. So how did you find that balance with being honest, yet protecting him? What was the criteria you used? How did you walk that fine line? Can you talk a little bit about that?
That was really tough. It's also tough not to portray a person in my husband's situation as a villain or this really evil person when he really wasn't. And so what I tried to do to tone that down was to, it was more of what was in my head, me trying to rationalize what was going on, me thinking about, well, if I do this, maybe this will happen. And trying to have some compassion for him in my thoughts, even though it was difficult with some of the things that were happening at the time.
Any other ways that you tried to not villainize him? Because I do think that this is a struggle. And obviously it's your memoir, it's your memory. And that may be what your memory, how your memory is contextualizing it. But I know that you probably wanted to honor him in some way. Were there any other strategies you used?
There was another character in the book that I was in contact with a lot, especially after my husband's symptoms got worse. And that was his older brother. And that he lived on the Oregon coast, that's where my husband's family is from. And so I was on the phone with him a lot. Usually he would call me and just check in on me, see how things were going. But he really struggled to accept that his brother, this is his youngest brother, had a mental illness, because there were three boys in the family, all older than my husband by quite a number of years. And it was just hard for him to accept. And during those conversations, I was struggling too through some of them until I understood what was going on. And then I would often explain to him, you know, this is what's happening. This is the way it is. And in the end, there was really nothing that we could do, because my husband, the way the mental health system is set up, my husband had to make that decision. But because of his condition, he was unable to make a decision to get help.
How did you change in your thinking about mental illness, kind of the narrative arc from the time you started in 2006, was it, to the time mm-hmm. you kind of put that last period to the end of the book? Where did you grow in your thinking about it?
I'm going to back up before I started writing the book. One of the big struggles I have, and people still have this struggle, is getting information. When you are going through something like this, whether you're on the side of the caregiver or you're on the side of the person who has a mental illness, it's hard to know where to start. And usually where you start, you're going to end up somewhere else, because a lot of places don't want to release information. I discovered during this journey that there are a lot of organizations out there who say they will help, but they don't. They don't provide information. They will treat you like a hot potato. And so they just throw you off somebody else. And it took a lot of time for me to finally find a place where I could get some information. That was the National Alliance on Mental Illness. And that was through a series of phone calls. They had a class for caregivers called Family to Family. And when I took that class, it was what I needed. I needed information. And that's also part of how my mind works as a journalist with that journalist training. I needed to understand what was happening, what I could do, and if there was anything that I could do to try to convince my husband that he needed help. And that class, it fulfilled all that and more, gave me the information I needed. But it was really hard for me to find out about that class. And unfortunately, today, now I took that class in 2004, so that's been 20 years ago. It's still hard for people to get to that point of finding out where they need to go to get the help they need.
So that really framed your thinking then as you started this journey of writing your memoir.
Exactly.
So in closing, I would love it if you would just share with our audience, people who are wanting to write their own memoir, share some maybe hard memories from their past. Can you encourage them? What would you say to them if they're stuck or if maybe they're reluctant to start? What words would you give to them?
I can share some additional experiences that I did as I was going through this process. One thing I would say up front, don't procrastinate like I did, but I would also encourage people to pace themselves. If you are getting to a point where you need to take a break, do it. Do something you enjoy. For me, that was mostly going out on a walk somewhere. I love the outdoors. I also love photography. So sometimes I would combine the photography with a walk. So like if the rhododendrons were in bloom here in the spring, I would take out my camera and practice close-ups of the blossoms or something like that. Another thing I did a lot was found some music that would relax me. And not only would I listen to it when I wasn't writing, but I would also put it on when I was writing. And my musical tastes are all over the map, but I tended to gravitate toward classical music during that time. It was very soothing as I was writing. And the other thing that I think a lot of writers share this experience, once I started writing and the more I wrote, it was almost like a therapy session. So getting the words, I write on the computer. Some people write by hand. However you get the words on the page or in the computer, wherever it goes, it was almost like a therapy session in a way, even though nobody was giving me advice or encouraging me or anything. It was almost like the container, like my computer or a notebook, a journal, was holding the words. And for some reason, it's hard to explain, but in a way that it became comforting and I started looking forward to writing. Another thing is to having somebody you can be accountable for. And even if you're unable to pay for an editor or like a development editor or a business coach like I had, there are friends out there. There are writing groups who can help you be accountable. There are a lot of them online. And that's another thing I forgot to mention. I did attend a lot of writing groups during this process. And there's one here that I absolutely love. It's called The Power of the Pen. We meet on Meetup. There are different people who lead the group, and most of the groups meet online. And just checking in with them two or three times a week made a difference, because that also encouraged me to continue writing. They were writing, so I should be writing.
We're so grateful that you are here with us today, Cheryl. Thank you so much for sharing your journey. And I really hope that people go and pick up your book, because it sounds like a really important message and really helpful for people who do have mental disorders in their families. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate having the time to talk about this book. And I hope that people do find a message of encouragement and hope from it.
So where can our readers find you? Where can they find the book? We know the name, The Best You Can Do, but I'm sure you have an author website. Where can they go to find out more about when it's being released and when they can purchase it?
So that is located on my business website. My business website is Tabby Cat Communications, and the URL is tabbycatgo.com/books. And that has all the information about the books that I've written and what's coming up. I am self-publishing the book. It will be on Lulu, and also it will be distributed to all the places that books are sold. So they can find it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, in their bookstore. They can order it through their bookstore, wherever.
All right, Dave, let's turn to our words of the episode. I want you to go first this week.
Okay, so my word is inure, I-N-U-R-E, to inure. So it's when you become accustomed, or someone becomes accustomed to something, especially something unpleasant. And there's another meaning, which is to come into operation, is kind of more of a legal thing, a release given to one of two joint contractors, inures to the benefit of both, to come into operation or take effect. But the first one, which is to basically become accustomed to something unpleasant. Here's an example. I became inured to her constant drip of how hard her life had been. Another one is, as we've aged, we each have become inured to each other's heady traits.
Yes, I love that. That's a great word. It sums up, again, so many words in one word.
I thought, you know, I don't know that I've heard this word many times, read it many times, I should say. And I thought, gosh, I need to make sure that I know the nuance of it. And I'm not sure I fully did, but this, it just related to something unpleasant. So you become accustomed to something, especially that was unpleasant, but it becomes kind of, you just kind of begin to ignore it.
All right. So as you know, I'm going to Italy in October. So I picked an Italian phrase, which I stumbled upon this week when I was doing some research on another word for words of the episode. And I'm going to try to say it in my best Italian accent, which will be terrible, but it's dolce far niente. There's like niente. I don't know how Italians do it. I've got to work on it, but it's D-O-L-C-E space F-A-R space N-I-E-N-T-E. And it means the sweetness of doing nothing. Pleasant relaxation and carefree idleness, which I think is just a wonderful phrase that Americans are pretty terrible at experiencing. And it became really popular after the Hollywood movie Eat, Pray, Love came out, which is based on the memoir, speaking of memoirs, of the American author Elizabeth Gilbert. So she used it when she was talking about her time in Italy, when she did Dolce Far Niente. Nothing. Then there was a sweetness to it. So here it is in a more popular way. And this was found in a travel magazine, Condé Nast Traveler. And I thought it was a great sentence. If work from home has become always working from home, MSC Cruises, MSC Seashore, which is a company that does cruises, has the antidote. A Caribbean cruising oasis with plenty of places to savor il dolce di niente. So they're talking about how working from home used to be like kind of the sweetness of life. And now, because it no longer is, you got to get away. And there are these oases that you can travel to that offer you that sweetness of doing nothing. So I don't know if I'll ever actually use it, because I think I'm going to be way too self-conscious of my accent, which is not good at all. But it's good to know.
And you probably, while you're there, since you're only there for a short time, probably won't be doing much of nothing.
Probably not. It's going to be a lot of doing wonderful, fun things. So, right.
Well, I look forward to hearing about the trip. I love that phrase.
All right. Well, that's another wonderful episode. It's so great to have authors who are doing the work of writing on the podcast. I loved it today. I loved having Cheryl with us. All right. I'm Melissa Parks.
And I'm Dave Goetz.
Now buckle up and write.